Welcome to the Sunday Times Politics Weekly, where we bring you the insights and interviews of the elections that have just passed. I am Mike Siluma, and thanks for joining us. This time on the Politics Weekly, in this episode, we reflect on the week that brought a tectonic change in South African politics. And also, we'll be talking about where the country might be headed to going forward. Joining us for today's conversation are Dr. Stembile Mbete, who is a senior lecturer in the politics department at the University of Pretoria, as well as Lizega Tandwa, who is the Times Live's politics editor.
Don't start trouble. Nobody's going to announce tomorrow. The results are not correct. If that happens, people will be provoking.
You're dealing with Jacob Zuma. Every stage is a theater for him.
Floyd will be a minister of finance if they agree, these people, because
the EFF and the ANC could still come together, possibly not if they make sure Floyd Chivambu, the Minister of Finance, as we have heard that demand.
If you come to us with a demand that Ramaphosa must step down as a president, that is not going to happen.
The broader question is whether our foreign policy has completely lost its way.
The people of Palestine, they're denied the right to enjoy the freedoms we so love.
That is a no-go area.
Welcome to the both of you. Now, the biggest surprise, I would say, of the election was the performance of the MKP, Mkhonto we Sizwe Party. What can we ascribe that to? I mean, they completely displaced the ANC in KZN, and they distorted even the national count, you know, or picture in terms of the balance of power between the political parties. What can we ascribe that to? Shall we start with you, Dr. Mbete?
Sure, thank you. I think that this election is the election where the ANC lost to the ANC in different ways. Partly the losses that they had to the MKP, to a certain degree to like the PA and other parties, you know, like that. Secondly, it was a loss to the stay-at-home vote. I mean, turnout nationally was 58% in this election, which is a drop of 8 points from 2019, where turnout was 66%. So people just did not turn out to vote in this election. And so I think this is the election that the ANC lost to itself. And MK Party is a big part of that loss. I think that the ability that they had to mobilize support in a very short amount of time in KZN, certainly helped by having former President Zuma as the face of the party. But also, I think it's emerging, what's beginning, a picture's emerging that looks as though what MK was able to do was to sort of cannibalize the ANC's own structures in KZN. So it didn't need to develop its own structures. It used the ANC's structures to assist in its organizing and in its campaigning. And what the MK was also able to do was to then mobilize a lot of interest and enthusiasm in participating in the election in KZN. So voter turnout in KZN was 62% compared to the national average, which was 58. If you look at provinces where the ANC has a big support base and got a big share of the vote, like Limpopo, the voter turnout there was like 53%. So the national variations in turnout really helped the MK have an impact, not just in KZN, but on the overall result. Then the last thing I'd like to say about it is that I think even MK itself was surprised at the extent of its national reach, because MK got votes and substantial numbers of votes, even in the Western Cape, in the Northern Cape, you know, in they didn't perform as well in the Northwest. But, you know, in the MK got votes in every province, almost every, you know, in a substantial number of wards in the country. It wasn't just concentrated in KZN, which allowed it to have a bigger national influence than I think even MK leaders were expecting.
but Liz, I'd like for you to come in. You know, what does that tell us? I mean, Dr. Mbete talks about MK cannibalizing ANC structures? Where was the ANC looking? What does this tell us about
the
state of the ANC in the country, but also in KZN? You know, because one would have expected that if all parties are campaigning, you are in touch with your structures, you know who's who, you know, you're not going to get nasty surprises. Mm. You know, so what happened here?
I think you've answered that question, Bramike, in that the ANC has always been inward looking, right? And to a certain degree, it told us this renewal that it had endeavored upon, that it was going to stop being inward looking and rather focus on the communities. And they started that with how they incorporated communities with their elections process, their internal elections processes. If you remember, with Khalima Motlanthe joining. So that period was a period of the ANC seemingly finding a way to be able to engage with communities, but somehow along the way it lost that. And it also was an issue in that they were also challenges, outward challenges, you know, the country's challenges, which the ANC as the incumbent mm-hmm. has to take responsibility for. Mm-hmm.
For example?
Yes, for example, load shedding, for mm-hmm. example, our water crisis, the economy, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But if you look at, for instance, in KZN, what Ste was just saying, in KZN, the cannibalism that she's talking about, I remember speaking to, because I'm on the ground, I remember speaking to one of the KZN comrades, as it were, who was saying, hey, the MK took Zweli structures, mm-hmm. structures which were Zweli's in 2020, Zweli Mkhize, which were his in 2022. And then it took that and it morphed into something that they didn't expect themselves. You have people like, for instance, Biggie Mdolo, you have the Sboniso Duma. You could see the kind of language, the attitude, the posture that they had when it came to the monarch, when it came to the churches, when it came to just the branches on the structures in itself. And National wasn't able to contain that. There is that, I think there was a sort of disunity, for lack of a better word, in how National was looking, or the top seven, the top structure was looking at the broader picture mm-hmm. in Gauteng as well. What was going on in Gauteng in terms of the situation, the transformers, which came very late, even though Banyaza Lusufi was trying.
Yeah.
In all that he could to kind of change the situation, it came very, very, very late. I think the ANC has continued to be inward looking. It has continued to be, to use Julius Malema's words, very arrogant. And it really, really affected and punished them.
Yeah, yeah. I think that maybe before we get off, because we've got quite a lot of ground to cover, before we get off the MKP phenomenon, what constitutes that party? If you, for example, you remove Jacob Zuma, there are 2 million people voting for that party. What are they voting for? I presume these are not card-carrying members of the ANC who have left because they've got ideological. I don't know. But it seems to me that it's built around a person and his daughter or something to an extent. So the 2 million people who voted for, I mean, Dr. Mbete, you've just said almost across the country. What were they voting for? What's the attraction?
Upsetting the ANC, I think, is a big attraction. And those people that wanted to send a message to the ANC, and specifically the ANC of Cyril Ramaphosa. Mm-hmm. I think there's a big part of that. I think that from President Zuma.
Hang on, when you're saying of Cyril Ramaphosa, are you saying that it's antipathy towards Cyril Ramaphosa himself, or is it a kind of broad description of the state of the party?
No. I think it's antipathy to Cyril Ramaphosa himself as an individual, but also and perceiving what is wrong with the party as being directly attributable to him. Mm-hmm. I think that there's people also that voted because former President Zuma is a likable guy. Yeah. I was not there when he arrived at The Rock on Saturday night. Mm. I came just afterwards, so I missed the actual arrival. Mm. So by the time I arrived, most people were inside the press conference. But the ones that I saw, one came up to me and she said, you know, Ste, I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but I also ran and tried to take a picture. She's like, I was in the mob. She said, I was so, in the mob. She said, it felt like there might be a stampede.
Yeah. Is it like a charisma thing?
A charisma. Oh, really? I think he's probably the most charismatic politician alive.
Listen, some people would say, populist.
Populist.
Populists are charismatic.
Yes, it may be, but when you say populism, there's also a particular policy stance or an approach to the world that is implied in that. This is just that people like the man and like him to the point of obsession.
That's interesting because the people who hate him also hate him
with a passion.
Yeah. You know?
And so I think there's a bit of that that's mixed in. And then just wanting change, wanting something that'll just disrupt the system for us to get out of this. You know, I think that this is the first election where you can accurately describe it as people literally voting with their stomachs and not voting with their stomachs because they want tenders, but voting with their stomachs because we have a hunger crisis in this country. People are not just poor or people are not just unemployed. People are hungry. And so there's a real sense of like desperation, I think, that comes with that. And people just wanted to shift things and to change things. Yeah, and I think they've achieved that, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. You've done a lot of legwork on the ground.
I was saying to colleagues that I think Zuma himself should be studied by academics. The man has managed to reinvent himself so many times and has survived.
Any PhD students who are interested, let me know.
But in terms of what Steyn is saying, mainly about his popularity and voters voting because, you know, of bread and butter issues, I'm struggling with that. Because not too long ago, July 2021, what we saw as an advent of President Jacob Zuma going to jail, you know, the disruption in terms of our economy, what we saw in terms of his disdain for the Constitution, the years in which he was the leader of this country. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the clips, Bramaik, of his daughter, Ududuzile, being questioned by one of our own Soweto's editor, Umabi Samakunga, asking her about general questions about the MK party's manifesto, which she should know, given that she's in the NEC, about the economy. And you couldn't get a clear, concise answer about what exactly is it that they are bringing to the people. I'm still trying to, because it's really, for me, I'm boggled by why such a phenomenon around this particular party and this particular man, given that we didn't even have anything tangible going into these elections. I mean, it was 12 points. Their manifesto was 12 or 13 points.
Yeah.
And there was nothing substantial to tell us as a new party. What exactly are you promising us outside of the populist language that Dadu Zuma was spewing out when he would stand in front of his supporters around young women who should be thrown to Robben Island? I mean, talking about changing the constitution, talking about elections, amending the structure of the elections. And that is not something that you would expect from someone who has been a sitting president.
Yeah.
So it boggles the mind. I will say that again. I still maintain that he needs to be studied in the way that he affects the body politics, but also affects South Africans in whatever he says, ridiculous as it might be.
Can I just tag on to that just as a last thing that I think, but there's something really profound when you speak to also supporters of from President Zuma that they don't think any of it was his fault. He has the most extraordinary ability to remain blameless. So, you know, July unrest was the Constitutional Court's fault. Even him having to be, you know, even that case against him was Zondo's fault. It's always somebody else's fault. And so it's then easy, then it's not mental gymnastics to then say, well, he's the one who's going to fix it, because it wasn't his fault in the first place.
Yeah. Now, let's go to the here and now and try to look forward. I'm sure we'll be discussing MKP and Jacob Zuma for a long time.
For a long time.
Yeah. And the students will be studying him and they will tell us. Yes. They'll dissect him and tell us what kind of a political animal he is. Now, the ANC, despite losing its majority, remains a key player in whatever happens going forward. Shall we look at the options that are before it? You know, I've heard talk of a minority government. I've heard talk of a government of national unity. And I've heard of this fancy term, which sounds like supply and demand.
Confidence.
You know, that kind of. So can we just explore them quickly? You know, Dr. Mbele, do you want to lead us on that?
Sure.
Each in turn to say what structurally, you know, for someone who's not close to politics or who's not a student of politics, what do these terms mean?
Okay. So in politics, a minority government is a government that is set up by the largest party in after an election. So a party that hasn't won a majority, which is 50% plus one, but has won the largest share of the vote on its own. And basically in that kind of arrangement, that party goes out on its own to set up a government. And what they hope for is that they can convince some of the other parties to vote there. So we've got a kind of parliamentary system where the president is elected out of parliament. He's elected by the MPs. And so where you can convince other parties to vote for your candidate, or hope that, because what we've got in our system is at that first sitting of parliament, there'll be nominations for presidential candidates, for people to be elected. And if there are more than two people that have been nominated, so let's say three or four, your first set of votes, and there's a vote that happens, and the first set of votes are majority, and no one gets a majority, so over 50%, then you do an elimination round to eliminate the fourth, to eliminate the third, and then there's two, so you until there are two left. And the one of the two that gets the majority is the one that wins. And that becomes president. If both of them get an equal number of votes at any point in the voting, then the meeting stands down and reconvenes in 7 days. So in a minority government situation, what you hope for is that the other parties don't find one person that they all agree on and convene, you know, and organize around. So then your candidate can get elected because you do have the most votes in, you know, compared to the others as a single block. And so you can get that the majority of the votes cast, right? So if others decide to abstain, and we've had this happen before, then it works out that you're the ones that get your person
in.
And the cabinet comes out of your party. So you can organize the president then as the executive authority can organize his cabinet as he feels. The challenge with that option is that even if you do get your candidate as speaker or get your candidate as president through, you then have to really fight to get everything else passed. So because you still need the majority of votes to pass the budget, to pass certain pieces of legislation, you're also at risk in the situation of a vote of no confidence because you don't have the majority. And so it leaves you quite vulnerable to the legislative sphere, if you don't have any other deal with that. So that's a minority government. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The second option that has been bandied about is of a government of national unity, which would be basically the largest party, which is the ANC, inviting other represented parties into a governing coalition of some kind that would basically entail sharing cabinet positions and also
positions in parliament, whether that would be speaker roles or chairpersons of committees. The difficulty with that is that we have 18 represented parties this year. We used to have 14. There are 18 parties represented in parliament. It's still not clear who's going to be approached and who's not, but if you're approaching all 18, that's a hugely clunky coalition.
Yeah.
Mm. And doesn't bode well. It's not very stable and will be very difficult to manage all of those different interests. And it doesn't seem to me that it's particularly necessary because as much as we've had an election that was majorly disruptive, we haven't had there wasn't so much conflict that we need a conflict resolution. But often governments of national unity come out, like the one we had in 1994, come out of periods of conflict.
Where there are major differences. There are
major differences and major issues. It doesn't feel to me like that's where we are. But that is how a government of national unity would work. And then there's a third option that has been raised, which is this confidence and supply, which is basically for the ANC to reach an agreement with the DA and IFP is who has been written about, to basically say that the ANC forms a minority government, perhaps, or it forms a government with, so in the executive, will be composed either of only the ANC or maybe the IFP also be having some cabinet ministries. The DA takes control of parliament, of the legislative sphere. So the ANC keeps the executive. The DA gets control of important aspects of the legislative sphere. Speaker, deputy speaker of parliament, and then the chairperson gets the chairs of various portfolio committees. And in this scenario, the ANC then would have the freedom to form its own cabinet with its own leaders. You wouldn't necessarily see big shifts around foreign policy, for example, because foreign policy is an executive function in our constitution. The role of parliament is limited to sort of ratifying pieces of legislation and then also holding the executive accountable oversight. But it is an executive function. And then the DA, and it would work for both parties because they wouldn't then have to unify on their policy platforms. Their manifestos wouldn't have to be linked or anything. And so they also wouldn't be able to claim each other's victories or, you know, be associated with each other's failures, technically or theoretically. And there's a number of countries where this arrangement already exists, right? So has existed in different times. So Canada currently has that. The Spain, Turkey. There's a few countries that have this arrangement. So that's the confidence. And the good thing about that then for the ANC is that the confidence part is that the DA and IFP would agree not to vote against the ANC in a vote of no confidence. Mm-hmm. So they would always support the president in the vote of no confidence. And then the supply part is that those parties would also vote with the ANC on the budget.
Okay.
And then on other pieces of legislation, it would be on a case-by-case basis according to the views of each of the parties. Okay. And then there's a fourth one that's been spoken about, but I don't know if it's really on the option, which is an actual coalition between the ANC, DA, and IFP, where it would then be governing to get. That's the John Steenhuisen,
the Grand President
one. And I'm not sure how viable that is. And then there's, of course, the fifth one that's being spoken about a lot on social media, of having an ANC, EFF, IFP coalition and having them co-govern together.
Okay. Just going into partnerships, Liz, again, I'd like for you to come in here. You know, let's look at the potential partners and see, you know, which is more likely to work out reasonably smoothly, you know, to the extent that politics in South Africa allows. If we look at the DA, what would be the benefits and the negatives of going with the DA?
I think Steer's explanation of the different models which the ANC is looking into kind of gives you an idea of which party would agree and which party wouldn't. The DA, for instance, just as background, the DA has one of its red lines, which is it would not go into a coalition with an MK party and the EFF if the ANC resorts to that. So a government of national unity isn't particularly something that they would look for. They have looked, for instance, in the supply and confidence. They like that idea. They like the idea of a minority government, which would infuse itself as well as, the DA as well as the IFP. There's been a lot of talk around, when you're coming to your question, there's been a lot of talk around the DA and stability and what the markets are saying.
It's almost a given.
I was saying to someone, it's coming into the realm of propaganda now, the way it's just been, you know, everyone is starting to believe that if we have another format or other different political parties coming in with the ANC, then the RAND crashes.
Yeah.
So that is one disadvantage which people have batted around. But in terms of the, and also in terms of the disadvantages is, which is what the NEC has been deliberating on Thursday about, is how it affects them in their structures. They already weakened in terms of their structures, especially the big provinces, Gauteng and KZN, and Gauteng in terms of populace with the electorate. So does that weaken them even further? The fact that, you know, they move against the, you know, they talk about the NDR a lot. They talk about the working class agenda.
Yeah.
What does it say to their ideology, the alliance with the SACP and COSATU? What, how does it factor into those already formed structures? And also, given that there's also talk about the DA, for instance, Taylor was talking about the DA getting some positions in cabinet, and the DA has said that if it gets into that kind of coalition with the ANC, it would want a sealed arrangement, which means that it controls, let's say, finance. If it elects its own minister of finance, then it then advances its own policies. Of course, we know the ANC won't support that, but this is essentially what the DA will mean. And then there are smaller nyana skeletons in the ANC, Brahma. Yeah. You know that.
Plenty.
Yes. So if the DA now becomes, you know, controls the overseeing parliament, that then we start to see now the ANC, the whole rot of the ANC begins to unravel.
Yeah.
And, you know, you remember Pravin Gordhan, him, you know, being so arrogant against parliament. That ceases to exist because he doesn't, I mean, his people don't control that parliament anymore.
There's no
the
protection.
Speaker, we've seen how important that position of speaker, Baleka Mbete, how she's protected, or Jacob Zuma for years. That becomes a disadvantage to the ANC. But in terms of the DA, and Stay might come in, because I'm yet to kind of get a clear picture in how the DA, outside of the fact that they, if they go into a coalition with the EFF and MK, it raises questions within the constituency. But what we've seen is that business wants a coalition between the DA and the ANC. That's and in fact, their own constituency doesn't seem to have repelled that idea of an ANC DA coalition. But what a DA coalition with the ANC and those parties, because the ANC has said also that Fikile Mbalula was saying on Thursday, in fact, that, you know, they're not looking at the smaller nyana parties. So the parties that didn't get a significant number, they won't really have any conversations with them unless necessary. So that means it takes out Rise Mzansi, it takes out Action SA, ATM, and all the other fellas. So they're looking at the parties with significant numbers, your IFPs, your EFFs, your PAs, and so forth. But I hope I've explained it. I know I've been going on and on.
No. I think Dr. Mbete can come in as well. You know, the response of people in what would be, you know, someone like Lindiwe Sisulu, for example, I would say, like what just as for one, you know, the response seems to be quite virulently opposed to an ANC DA arrangement. What do you think would happen if the ANC decided to go having considered all things, and then they decided, well, maybe they could able argue it's in the best interests of the country and the economy, et cetera, et cetera. What impact would that have on the ANC?
Well, I think it's been very interesting to see the people who are uncomfortable with any kind of agreement with the DA are calling all possible agreements with the DA coalitions.
Mm. Mm.
And that language then makes it seem, implies, a ideological sort of meshing of the parties and needing to govern together and taking away all the autonomy, basically, of the ANC.
Mm.
And while I think that there is that option of a full coalition, probably, I think, still on the table for some people, the other arrangement of the ANC securing a minority government with the votes that it needs in the legislature, in parliament for the most important things, would require cooperation with the DA, but does not necessarily require an alignment on policy, an alignment on governance, and could be done with some autonomy for the ANC. The challenge, of course, with that arrangement, with the confidence and supply arrangement, is not so much the kinds of things that Lindiwe Sisulu was speaking about. It is things like the constraints that it puts on the legislative agenda going forward. So what law is already there, what progressive law is there, minimum wage, for example, couldn't be reversed, I don't think, on that agenda, because it couldn't be reversed. Even if the DA decided to use private members' bill to introduce it, there wouldn't be enough votes in parliament to vote for it,
just
right?
And the ANC
wouldn't be committed to voting with the DA for that. So things like the minimum wage, black economic empowerment, employment equity, I think would be pretty secure because they already exist in law. Mm. The challenge would be for any future progressive agenda or agenda on lawmaking for redress or that. So it would be harder to get those things through parliament, especially because of how much power actually the speaker has, right, in terms of influencing scheduling. And there's all sorts of things that the speaker can influence. And so it would really hamstring a lot of future legislative initiatives from the executive. And then a last thing I want to say is I find it interesting how little we're talking about the IFP. So there's two things that have been missing from this conversation. Mm. The one is the sweet spot of the IFP, because a lot of the discussion is also, it's not just about the national level, but then what are the consequences in the provinces?
Mm.
So in KZN, for example, where MK has 37 out of the 80 seats, there's 5 other parties that make up the rest of the 43. The IFP has 15, ANC has 14, EFF has 2, DA has 11, NFP has 1. So there's other parties that have got... So how are governments going to be made in KZN? And then how are governments going to be formed in Gauteng? Are issues that are going to inform the national level discussion.
Okay, so you're not going to go have like a separate do-it-yourself arrangement in the different provinces.
We might, but you'll want to be talking about what the implications of all of this are. And I think the IFP is in a really sweet spot in that regard, in that it is a potential, not sort of kingmaker, but it would be useful and good for the ANC to have the IFP on its side, whichever way the negotiations go. The second thing that I don't think is coming up, it started to in the last sort of 48 hours or so sufficiently, is the alliance. And like, what is the future of the alliance from here, whichever arrangement is made?
Yeah.
The ANC, the tripartite alliance, SACP, COSATU, we have heard in the last few, day or so, their views about where they feel. Because, and I think this is where I sort of want to end, is that this is not just a technical or an administrative conversation. It's also a fundamentally existential one.
Yeah.
What is the ANC after this? Who is the ANC after this? What is the culture? What is the nature? What's its ideology? How is it postured? Because we've seen now the end of the ANC as a broad church. Parts of the denominations of the church are now outside. MK, EFF, Broken Way.
Yeah.
And so what is the ANC now?
Okay.
And what does it become?
Okay.
And I think that's why this conversation is so fraught, right?
Yeah,
and so complicated is because it seems to be, it is, I think, very much getting to the heart of what this 112-year-old organization is and what it continues to be.
I want us to look at the other options, parties. You mentioned the IFP. But before we get off the DA, you know, I've struggled to find many people who are highlighting the possible benefits of the ANC going with the DA. Are there any, or do the risks outweigh the negatives outweigh the positives by far?
Look, I think that there are benefits in terms of shifting some of the way that the party operates and shifting the culture of the party. In the sense that
of the ANC,
in the sense that you now have to be a lot more kind of craft competent. And by that, I mean, you now need to really learn how our system works and what you can use leverage on. And that can help in pushing against any of the pressures around rent seeking and the corruption because you don't have as much to play with. Right.
Essentially, it's better for us.
It's better for us. But for those people in the ANC that have been wanting to fight this battle around, now you actually have the circumstances for which you then can fight against the corruption and the whatever. And you need to then be making decisions in ways that will get them through parliament and all of those things. So it shifts a lot more of the discussion to statecraft and out of kind of party political battling.
Yeah.
So there is that advantage for a part of the ANC. I think that there's a way in which the ANC will be able to evolve as a party of government, operationally in terms of its statecraft out of this, just because of the challenge with DA. The second thing that could be a benefit, and maybe this is also a benefit more for us than for the ANC, but that it forces a very big conversation about who the hell are you and what are you going forward?
Yeah.
Which I think has been a discussion that all of these tough discussions that have been able to be postponed for years, and decades even. And I think that this will, for the party to be able to operate as an executive. And then the last thing for me, which is important, is that on issues, it allows for a great deal more continuity on some of the things that have been important. So on foreign policy, for example, if you've got your own cabinet and you've got your own justice minister and you've got your own international relations minister, then it creates a much more continuity. It creates the conditions for continuity on things like the ICJ, if you control the executive.
Yeah.
It also provides a lot more agency for the ANC in terms of how to restructure government, because we know that part of the conversation that's going to be happening is reducing ministries and restructuring the state in order for it to, you know, to reduce costs, reducing deputy ministers and all of that sort of stuff. So in a situation where the ANC is allowed to be a minority government with this confidence and supply thing, it has a great deal more control over that process than if it were to bring in partners to co-govern with in the executive.
Okay. I think the other party that, well, it has not fared as well as many people would have expected, the EFF, but it does feature, you know, I see as part of some kind of arrangement going forward with the ANC. Elizabeth, do you want to come in here? An ANC EFF arrangement, even if it's got maybe the IFP as well in it. But would you say that, do you see the ANC saying never with the EFF? Or maybe, yes, there's a possibility of looking at the EFF as opposed to looking at the DA, for example.
I think that's why there's a big debate within the ANC, right? Is because they're caught in this conundrum where some are saying that a DA partnership is much better sustainable than an EFF partnership, where some argue that an EFF partnership would, for instance, we're aligned in terms of policy, we're aligned in terms of our agenda for progressive and Black people. But then there are misalignments, immigration, for instance. The EFF has been quite open about their open border policy. That's not where the ANC sees itself going. And also the situation, the experience that the ANC has had with the EFF in coalitions, and the experience the ANC has had with Julius Malema himself, which has been for all of us to see in the past couple of years at metros. So there is that debate, I think, within every single NEC member in that NEC. Is it, are we going to go with something that benefits the country, or are we going to go with something that benefits the party? And either or, there's going to be an argument that an EFF benefits the country and the party, and vice versa. But I think with the EFF, what they have is, I think they have that continuity. That's if Julius Malema can be able to hold on to that agreement, can keep that agreement for the next, for less than five months.
Yeah.
They do have continuity. I see that with the EFF and the IFP in terms of land. IFP may not agree in terms of without compensation, but they agree in terms of land expropriation.
And accommodation.
Exactly. Yeah. You can accommodate and compromise somewhere. So in terms of that arrangement, it could work. But then we also are shunning out. And someone was saying that, has been saying that to me, that we must be careful of closing out the MK voter.
Mm-hmm.
2 point something million people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's a reason why they voted for the MK. Mm-hmm. Whether it's for us, we are unaware of why they voted. We tried to figure it out, but they voted for them.
Mm-hmm.
So what then happens if you are, say, you are going to left-leaning? We know there's no leftist party in this country anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
They're more left-leaning.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you are going to the left-leaning parties, then why keep out a party which is essentially the ANC? Why keep that out of the conversation? Also, what do you say to that constituency? What do you say to those people? Are they insignificant to you? And it's a large number, and now the third largest party. So those are the kind of permutations that, you know, that the ANC has to deal with in the next week or so.
Dr. Mbete, you guys taken us from the EFF to the MK, you know, in one fell swoop, you know. Now, I wanted to ask, people are saying that, look, the EFF, despite its size, electorally speaking, could become a kind of conscience of the ANC, as it were, a left, well, Elizabeth says not really left, left-leaning, a left-leaning kind of conscience for the ANC, you know. Do you see a possibility, a viable kind of accommodation in, you know, having ANC EFF in one tent, maybe with another invitee?
They would need to have another invitee because they don't have enough seats together to be able to cross the 50 to get the 201 that they would need in Parliament. Look, the EFF and the ANC make the most sense ideologically in terms of each of their stated ideologies. The EFF and the ANC also, I think, are the best chance for creating that kind of progressive left, or having a more progressive sort of left agenda in policy and in lawmaking and in governance than just the ANC on its own or the ANC in cooperation with the DA. And so four things in like, you know, the austerity, you know, budgeting that we've been dealing with, all of those sorts of things, I think that the EFF would be really, would play a big role in sort of pushing back on some of those things if it was a partner in of the ANC's in cabinet. I mean, the EFF has said, I think they'll concede not having the finance ministry.
Yeah.
If they're a partner in cabinet, they'll be able to, I think, influence some of the discussions. I think the ANC EFF is also the most palatable to the majority of the ANC membership. And yeah, it just feels more comfortable, right? The biggest challenge of that arrangement is going to be the consistency. Can you keep the EFF in the arrangement for long enough?
Yeah.
And how long can it hold and be secure? In theory, it should be, right? I mean, but we've seen in the Gauteng metros that it hasn't been. And so I think that'll be the big issue. And then the second thing is sort of concerns around who does it embolden in the ANC. So back to these factional conversations, right? Who is it in the ANC that benefits the most from having the EFF in government with the ANC? It would still need, and this is the IFP's sort of trump card, it would still need the IFP probably, and the IFP more than other smaller parties. I think the ANC would want to then have the IFP in that arrangement to make up the numbers that they need. And so, so that's the... Because there's benefits to the ANC from that arrangement. I think there's big benefits for the EFF. I think this election for the EFF, yes, it didn't grow at all in the way that they were expecting to. There was a slight decline. But I think it was an important sort of signal to the EFF's been around for 10 years, which is longer than, you know, people were giving it when it started. And I think that this has been an important sort of signal about then how the party must evolve in the future, right? So people are saying, seem to be saying, well, your politics isn't exciting, isn't traction anymore. And we would like you to evolve how you do things. And I think this is a great opportunity for the EFF to do that as well.
Now, just there to go back slightly to MK. If you take MK into a coalition, right, or working arrangement with the ANC, you also have to take Jacob Zuma along, presumably. Somebody described him as poison. Nyanda said, we don't want that poison.
This is the very difficult thing, right? It's because the MK has said that they will only speak to they want Cyril out.
Yeah.
Now, in a negotiation, as an organization that's negotiating with another organization, and then that organization has as its red line, we want you to remove your leader, that's giving them 100%. Like, there's no grading. Either or. It's not even we want to control land or we want we want you to get rid of the president and put somebody else in or put our
person
in.
Basically cut your head off.
Yes. And it's hard. You can't negotiate from that place. And so I completely... I get what Lizaga is saying about the 2 million people that voted for MK. But because we're also not clear of which MK was voted for or which MK will continue to exist, because remember, this issue is still in the courts with Jablan Khumalo, taking the Zumas to court about taking the party from him. And so which version of MK is going to continue to exist? Who's going to speak for MK? Who's going to lead it? Those questions are actually still up in the air. And I think it would be wise to try to speak to MK about, you know, what preferences are and things. And if I remember correct, the statement yesterday was that they had tried to. But in a negotiation, the first request can't be cut off your head. because there's nowhere to there's nowhere else to go from there. And so, yeah, I think that what should be a principle, though, of the ANC going forward, whatever, you know, part of what's happening now is this urgency, right? Because Parliament has to sit on the 17th of June, 17th, maybe 18th. But it has to sit in the, one of those 2 days. And there needs to be a speaker elected. There needs to be a president. So there's this time deadline that I think is also a big feature here and that we need to think about. But I think that continued engagement with the MK certainly should continue even beyond whatever arrangement is decided
Somebody, Elizabeth, I'd like for you to, you know, to give us your perspective. Somebody said, if you bring in Jacob Zuma in any form and you work with him, essentially you can't talk about renewal.
No,
it's
no,
the
no.
death of renewal.
No,
the day he walks in the door,
completely.
The death of any talk of renewal.
Completely. I think it would be futile for, even if Zuma concedes to this demand of his that Cyril should leave the party or resign as president, for Cyril to stay after Zuma. In fact, I would be surprised if many who are with President Ramaphosa, who actually do believe in this notion of renewal. For instance, someone like Thabo Mbeki and Kgalema Motlanthe, I would find it hard for them, as much as they love the party and their legacy is intertwined with the party, for them to consciously stay in that party given their own feelings about President Jacob Zuma. And also, what does it say to the party that you can transgress and get away with it? What does it say to the rank and file? What they also have to be cognizant of the message that they're going to send with these coalitions to not only their supporters, the rank and file, but also, sorry, not only to their supporters, but the rank and file member, the branches which are at this time deflated, the branches which need guidance, the branches which would need to be revitalized in some way or the other. So a Jacob Zuma coming in would be disastrous.
An important point here is that Jacob Zuma can't occupy office. I mean, that's what the Constitutional Court said, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Zuma could not come back as the president or even premier of KZN or a minister. And so effectively what you would be bringing Jacob Zuma, the individual, into is back into the ANC, management of the ANC, and into influencing ANC decisions and that sort of thing. And so there's a big consequence for the party here, not just for the state, that needs to be considered and that needs to be thought of. And I think that those are some of the things that are that I think are definitely on the mind of the NEC around what are you doing, not just to the state, and we all hope that that is the primary thing that they are considering and thinking of, and the country, but also what are the consequences then for the party that you are running?
And if you look at, to interject, Bramaik, if you look at the strays that have ran to the MK party, kind of tells you what would happen if Jacob Zuma would. I mean, we're talking about, is it Nathi Nhleko, Des van Rooyens, you know, those individuals.
So they would all have to get the red carpet.
Well, they wouldn't. In some form or the other. Des van Rooyens was never expelled or suspended from the ANC, as far as I know. And I believe that he was actually in their list, in their provincial lists. I would have to double check that, but I do believe that he was in one of their lists. But that tells you of the caliber of people that are surrounding Jacob Zuma, and those are the people that the ANC just wanted to shed off.
But just lastly, you know, listening to both your perspectives on the challenges facing the ANC, probably also the DA. In fact, all the parties, in terms of the choices that they have to make, it looks like whatever choice they make is going to cause a lot of tensions internally. In other words, if you are an MK party person and suddenly Jacob Zuma wakes up one day and says, guys, we're going back, you know, kind of thing, you might say, but Cyril is still there. Why must we go back there? You know, and are we going to go to jail? Are they going to arrest us? What's going to, you know, kind of thing. If you're an ANC and maybe Cyril is talking about the DA, a lot of people will say, the likes of Lindiwe Sisulu, and others will say, no, no, this is a sellout, really. Why are you even putting this on the table? You know, get serious. The DA is the same. You know, they you know, working with the ANC, you know, the idea with the multi-charter thing was to get rid of the ANC. That was a big issue. And suddenly you're saying, maybe they're not so bad after all. Let's, you know, see if we can't work with them. What kind of leadership do you think is going to be required to manage all of this? Elizabeth, do you want to go first? No, because it looks like whatever choices you make, they are going to be tough, and they will require leaders who are able to carry at least a substantial portion of whatever party it is with them.
I'd say, for instance, Cyril Ramaphosa, I once asked him this question that it's been, in my view, I thought that was, he had the most difficult task with COVID-19 as a sitting president. I think the task of reuniting the ANC, because we're not talking renewal only now, it'd be the reunion of the ANC, reuniting the ANC after this will be a mammoth task for him. In that NEC alone, he faces rebellion, he faces a pushback. In the top seven of it, in itself, there is dissenting views about what would happen. And I imagine any decision that is taken is going to be felt as if it's a personal blow to any of them. So which means that his agenda, and which is part of his legacy of renewing the ANC, takes a huge knock. He's got about three more years of his second term in the ANC. So he has to make sure his legacy now goes hand in hand with the ANC dipping below 50%, the ANC losing for the first time elections. But also, his legacy could also go hand in hand with the ANC finally disintegrating as a party. So he needs to make sure that somehow he can be able to salvage something within his presidency. For John Steenhuisen, I would be smiling if I was John Steenhuisen. I don't see how, I mean, given where the DA, where we thought the DA would go, I mean, we thought the DA would decline, at least I thought the DA would decline from the 20s. There were polls that were saying that it was likely to decline at some point, and at some point they were saying that it would, maintain its average. So the DA at this point is sitting at a sweet spot. It has managed to, regain some sort of momentum. And John, who was seen as someone who wasn't favored by the markets. We remember there was Roger Jardine at some point whom the funders were toying around as a person who might take over from John. John at this point, and I think the DA to a large degree, is at a very powerful point as a party. Just talking in terms of the FedEx or the Federal Council, is really the disunity. I would imagine that whatever happens now, the factionalism or the talks of John leaving and who would take over, would succeed him, I think that has died down. I think they might have died down. I wouldn't see a reason why they would want John out at this point. They would not have a reason to point out at FedEx. So I think Cyril Ramaphosa is the person that I wouldn't want to be in his shoes at this point. Either way, whatever they decide, whether they go with the DA, whether they go with EFF and the IFP, even MK, it's going to taint his legacy. He's already had a blemish on his legacy, so it's going to further taint it.
Dr. Mbete, do we have the leaders with the capacity to pull this very difficult task, if you like, for the country, because it's not just about the political parties. It is about what happens with the country eventually, whatever their choices.
I think the biggest winner in the DA from this isn't John, it's Helen. Because this is Helen's victory.
Tell more.
Because it was Helen who drove the strategy post the loss, what was it? They got more votes in 2019 than they did in 2024. But to push Musi out and to shift the strategy of the DA from trying to be a 50% party to being okay with a 20-25% party, but that would have a lot of influence within our proportional representation system. And I think that's something that these are the things that are going to become so much more important in the way that we analyze and we think about our system. Is that from 1994 until now, or maybe until 2016 with the local government elections and the upsets there, we had a PR system, and we've got to close this. We've got the purest form of PR system that you could have. And we had one that behaved like a first-past-the-post-winner-takes-all system, where you had this very dominant, well over 50%, close to 70% party at some point. And where then in order to counter that party, you would need a strong second party. So we, at some point, it looked like we were going towards a two-party system, right? And a lot of the DA strategy was around that, to make it more inclusive, to make it more of a broad church, to dilute some of the liberalism in order to make it more attractive. As the ANC has seemed to be sort of eating itself in different ways, and there've been all of those battles, and the ANC sort of dominance as a vanguard party, as the leader of society, has declined. It's become it became unnecessary for the DA to try to grow to be an alternative ANC, because you then have had our proportional representation system, and PR systems are supposed to lead to inclusion, to a fracturing of politics. PR systems fracture politics. They don't unify it. So these million parties, these many parties that we have that emerged, the many parties that we now have in the legislature, is a feature of the system. It's not a defect. That's how the system, a purely closed-less PR system, works. So now we've got the system working the way that it does, that it's meant to. And so for the DA, they don't need to become as big as the ANC to counter the ANC. They can stay at 20-25%, even if there are other ways to actually have influence. Mm. And those ways don't entail John Steenhuisen being the deputy president.
But you're confident
So basically, I think that it's been the strategy to get to this point has worked really well for them, because they are going to influence whatever version of governance comes from here. What I don't know is that is whether that strategy will continue to be the one that works going into the future. And I think that there is going to be the potential, if that is the strategy that's then pursued forever, of alienating those Black people that have moved into the DA, that have tried to work to make the DA an alternative for the whole of society. I think for the ANC, either way, as I said earlier, this is an existential crisis. The ANC will not be the same after this, whichever way they go. And it's a big identity shift that will come from this. I think that I think it's really laudable and praiseworthy how the ANC has accepted this hit. There's not a lot of countries where dominant parties, liberation movements, take the hit.
Which is funny, because in the past, there was speculation. A lot of people did not believe that the ANC would, you know, voluntarily.
It has voluntarily accepted dominance,
you know, that there, you know, there might be violence, there might be sabotage of the electoral processes and all of that.
The ANC has voluntarily accepted its, you know, decline, and is going to work with others around it. But that is necessarily going to create a shift, an identity shift. What I want to say, though, is regardless of the members of each of these parties and all other parties, for me, the winner of this election is the voter. There were too few voters. But this election has shown the power of the vote in a way that we didn't really understand before. And what it's also done is it's galvanized conversations that around issues that were for politics geeks like me. So people are now talking about the lists, and they're talking about the formula to calculate seats. And they're talking about what's quorum for parliament. I mean, these things were never on the agenda. People never knew about them.
Yeah.
And now there's this interest into how the system actually functions. Where does our power really lie? And I went down a rabbit hole of KZN Twitter on Saturday night, and voters, you know, people who'd voted for MK who are like, but they must know what to be put them in, we can take them out.
Yeah.
So if they don't, once you've voted out a government, I was talking to a Zambian friend who said this. She was like, oh, South Africa, it's going to be lit. She says, once a people knows what it feels like to vote a government out, they're never giving up their
power. They'll use their,
they will use it their, again their, and again their and again.
Yeah. And Zambia would know.
And Zambia would know. And they would know.
But before we wrap up, do you have confidence in the kind of leadership across the board that they will pull this off, whichever way it goes? In other words, South Africa will still be intact, that we'll still have an economy at the end of the day, and that we will still have a future.
I have great confidence. Not the leaders. I'm not talking about them. I have great confidence in our institutions.
Mm. Yeah.
I think that what all of this is proving is just the resilience of the foundation that we're on, whether you like the foundation or not, right? So people that think that we should have another constitution, whatever.
Yeah.
Mm. But that we've, the framework with which, within which all of this is happening, has been repeatedly stress tested and has withstood that. And so, and that for me is enough for now.
Okay.
The leaders and what they do. And then the last thing is that capitalists want to make money. And so the boogeymanning around, you know, the rand's going and everything's going to collapse. And I think we speak in such extreme terms around the market in that way.
Mm.
And we use these terms to mean things that they don't mean. And so I think that, I think we'll be okay. It's going to be rocky. Mm. As I've said to my students, South African democracy is consolidating. What they lied to us about is that consolidation feels nice. Democratic consolidation does not feel good.
Yeah.
It's not a pretty process. Making sausages
is not a comfortable place to be.
But I think that it'll ultimately be for the good.
Okay. She's like, I think so too.
I agree with her. I agree with her on the institutions that we have. Mm. I agree with her. I think also we do have to give some level of credibility to the ANC and the fact that they have accepted this this outcome. I imagine under Jacob Zuma, given what he has done, that it wouldn't have been the case. So
would have taken, no, I shouldn't say that. I nearly said it would have taken out his what those grabber things that they were using. spy equipment.
But I think South Africans should be hopeful. I think the fact that we in a small way voters have really given their perspective of what things are, they have shown their unhappiness and they've shown what they want South Africa to look like. And now it's up to the powers that be to shape it to what we want it to look like as the electorate. I'm very hopeful. I think it's nice new times.
Yeah.
The new dawn is going to be coming.
The actual new dawn.
The real new dawn.
Yeah.
but as we wrap up, a housekeeping issue. This whole talk of a recount, or should we pay any attention to it?
No.
Could it upset everything or not? Mm.
So I've been saying to people this week that an interesting thing, and I didn't even realize it until it's now happening, is that there's a lot around our constitution, our electoral act, that was built for continuity. So the electoral act, those section 55 objections that people were speaking about, which are the objections that have got a material on issues that could have a material impact on the result. And that's a really important idea. What is a material impact on the result? A material impact on the result is that it would change the result. What is the result in our system? The result in our system is the seat allocations. So would what happened in one voting district, or the way that something was captured in a particular ward, so four voting districts, does that change the overall seat allocation
in the National Assembly or in those or in a provincial legislature. If it does not fundamentally change the seat, if it doesn't change the seat allocation, and remember, we've got a proportional system, so that you got lost 100 votes here, 100 votes there, may not necessarily change the overall doesn't really change the overall outcome. And so that is the test. And that's why the IEC could announce the result on Sunday. And that in the law, in the Electoral Act, it says that where objection, where the decision on objections is appealed to the Electoral Court, that there is a hear, that there is a case still being heard at the Electoral Court does not suspend the outcome of the election. Mm-hmm. So, and we've seen no evidence from the people that have said, the 26 that said that they were serious. We've seen them present no evidence that there were things that happened that would have changed the seat allocation to be something different. And we've also seen no evidence that they are appealing to the Electoral Court. I haven't seen that reported. Maybe it is there. And then the last thing is that the our Constitution, the way that Section 46 is written, that there's 350 to 400 seats and in our parliament, and for 350 to 400 elected women and men make up the parliament, make up the National Assembly. That they have been elected makes them MPs. They then can start their work once they take the oath of office. But if 58 or 60 or 70 or even 100 of those elected members of parliament decide not to go to the first sitting of parliament, makes no difference to the business of parliament. Mm. Parliament can keep operating. The National Assembly will have its meeting. The threshold that is in the rules about the election of a president and election of the speaker, it says the majority of votes cast, not the majority of people present.
Yeah, yeah.
And for all issues that are not, for all matters that are not votes on bills or amendments of bills, you need a third of parliamentarians present. So you need over 133 MPs to be present to vote for the speaker and to vote for the president. And so what that means is that the business of parliament continues. And actually, it would be a bonus if 267 MPs decided to boycott parliament, the ANC would have a full majority. It would have all the votes it needed to get its man in, you know? And so, our system is designed to continue.
So basically you're saying that, no, not to worry too much.
Don't worry too much.
You know, you shouldn't be anxious.
No. Remember also that that day when the MPs are being voted in, when they take their oaths of office, that's also when you start being onboarded onto the system. And I don't know how many people would decide not to be onboarded onto the system when you now know that you're going to get paid, was it 1.2 million?
That's for committee chairs.
Much money it is, and you're going to get a nice medical aid and all of those things. I think that there'll be a lot of, I don't think that we need to worry about disruption or that not happening. I don't think that there'll definitely be attempts, no doubt. But I think the system is designed to continue.
Okay. All right. We're going to have to wrap it up there on the Sunday Times Politics Weekly for this week. And I'd like to thank our guests, Dr. Stanbile Mbete, who is a senior lecturer in the politics department at the University of Pretoria, as well, of course, as my colleague, Lizaya Tandwa, who is the political editor for our digital platform, Times Live. Thank you very much for your time and for your interesting perspectives.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
I'm Mike Siluma, and until next time, do stay safe, stay blessed, and let's do good for our country.